Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Hello. Okay, well, hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. No, that's not right. Hello and welcome to the Future Proof. You can keep this in if you want. Hello and welcome to the Future Proof podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks for joining us. And if I may just reiterate, if you do like the show, please do share, subscribe, rate, you know, whatever it is that people do via Snapchat these days. We appreciate spreading the word. In particularly so this week, because this week we were lucky to have been honoured at the New York Festival's Radio Awards with gold and silver for a piece we did with an amazing man called Mark Pollock, who went blind, then paralysed, and then decided he was going to walk. And the story is unbelievable. You can find it in the podcast section of newstalk.com. But just want to say thank you for listening and for sharing. Now, Future Proof is on the road, heading to Blackrock Castle Observatory, Cork, for a space exploration special. It's going to be very exciting. I'll be joined by special guest astronauts Robert Thirsk and Yi Son Yeon, and there's loads more to celebrate the fantastic space program, the International Space University, which is in Ireland, in Cork, this year. So why not join us on Monday, July 3rd, as part of the audience? You can watch the show happen. It's very entertaining to see, you know, behind the curtain, I think, sometimes. Just go to newstalk.com/futureproofcork now. Tickets are free, but they're limited, so register quickly, please. Doors 11:30 a.m. sharp at the Blackrock Castle Observatory. Do not be late. We're recording live from 12 noon to 1 p.m. You have to register, and you have to show proof on the day, so have the ticket on your smartphone or print the tickets. Looking forward to seeing you there. Haven't been to the Blackrock Castle Observatory. Unbelievably, really looking forward to that. So if you can go, newstalk.com/futureproofcork. Looking forward to saying hello, but please don't touch me. All right, on this week's programme, we will be talking about the science of puberty and the weird things that affect it. And we're also going to have an Irish researcher come here and talk to us about the decision of the science of decision making and the things that we actually call decisions. It's a really interesting subject. His name is Redmond O'Connell, and he's in Trinity College, Dublin. But first, a whistle-stop tour of the world of science this week. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Dr. Fergus McAuliffe are here to take us through the more interesting headlines. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Mutation. It is the key to our evolution. It has enabled us to evolve from a single-celled organism into the dominant species on the planet. This process is slow, normally taking thousands and thousands of years. But every few hundred millennia, evolution leaps forward.
Evolution, it used to be so hip. I mean, it was a subject of pop culture, and, you know, people would go around, you know, selling out auditoriums, talking about, you know, the amazing thing that is evolution. It was in TV programs, and now it's just not fashionable anymore, Ruth.
I don't know about that, Jonathan. I mean, I think one of the best-selling books so far this year is Homo Deus, which looks forward to the future evolution of the human species. So that's really exciting. But I think what was in the news this week, which maybe for scientists is not such good news, is that in Turkey, the administration has decided to remove the teaching of evolution from secondary schools. They've said it's too complex for young people to understand. It'll be removed from all the ninth grade textbooks, and it'll be held for those who choose to go on to college and study. So I think there's great concern there among scientists that that's happening.
What is going on in the world? I mean, obviously there's industry at play in some parts of the world, and in America, politics is very much at play, and yeah, conservative values and so on. This is obviously linked to religion, I would imagine.
Sure.
As someone who studied as a geneticist and works at Science Foundation Ireland, looking out across the water, is it not really worrying, the trends that we're seeing?
I think it's hugely worrying. But I mean, and let's be clear, as you said, Turkey is not the only country that is having conflict between different sort of ethos and education, religion, science. I mean, this is something we've seen everywhere, even in places like Norway. So, you know, it's not confined to the Islamic world or the Middle East. I mean, we've all heard about it happening in the US. But I think it is a worry, and it comes down to us as scientists being very clear about what we are saying about evolution. you know, it was way back in the 1970s, the whole statement that was made by Dobzhansky, nothing in biology makes sense in the light of evolution. And there is no evidence that has come out of science over the last decades that refutes that in any way. In fact, we can see evolution happening in the laboratory at a bacterial level. So, you know, I think as scientists, we probably have to be a bit clearer about how sure we are.
Yeah, because like, I don't get how, because we can see this in zebrafish, we can see it in animals that reproduce really quickly, we can put them in a tank and watch evolution happen. I just, what is your explanation? Or either of you have an explanation as to why, when something is clearly a fact, it has been just dismissed as an idea so easily by people in power, by people making policies.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's also, you know, it's also just happening up the road as well, in the north as well, you know, with the DUP and such. But, like, I think part of it might be that, in a way, you're kind of, if you're losing control somewhat. So you're saying that there's this natural phenomenon at play, but we can't really control it. It's been around for ages, much longer than we have, and it kind of controls itself. So I think it is somewhat more of a lack of power on our part, and
it
maybe a lack of a control.
It unsettles us in our core in some way, that basically our decisions or our lives are basically in some way pre-programmed.
And I think the timescales are really, really hard to get your head around. I mean, I think when you talk about geology, you know, and things going back hundreds of thousands of years and even millions of years, it's really hard for people to get those concepts into their head. And I think that makes it really challenging.
Yeah, or even the whole fact that often people turned to religion to explain natural phenomena and stuff like that. So if we're saying that it's not religion, then what else is it? You know.
So I have this theory, right? This is my big idea. And if you are a scientist, I would love to hear your thoughts on this. I think that we should find some way of grading our ideas when it comes to biology or like the theory of evolution in terms of degrees of certainty. So if you remember when the Higgs boson announced, there was this phrase they used, that we've reached 5 sigma, yep, which basically meant that we are absolutely 99.999% sure that the Higgs boson exists. And basically it was just a way of saying we're really sure. So 1 sigma was, you know, this is interesting, but we don't have any faith in the results yet. And 5 sigma is, we're absolutely concrete that this is a physical phenomenon. And I think people don't know how sure we are of evolution, partly because of the language of the word theory, which I think everyone would go back and change that idea. But we're not 100% sure on the idea of evolution, because we haven't been told how clear we are on it, versus something like when Africans came out of Africa and populated the world. The recent, you know, change that went from 200,000 years ago to 300,000 years ago, that's a huge jump. So I think if we could categorize our certainty, Then the public would go, okay, well, you know, when someone publishes a story that says we have the perfect equation for the ideal hamburger, you know, we know that is a sigma zero scientific study, but the theory of evolution, we have so much to support it, that is a sigma five theory. And I'm very serious about this idea. So if you are a scientist, I'd love to know your thoughts. You can text us 53106.
Are we going to call it the McCritty scale of
certainty? It could become a thing. Right. The next story is to do with something completely different. It's to do with sea pickles and a sort of a aquine mystery.
Yeah, these guys are great. They're called the unicorns of the sea because they're really rare and really weird. So imagine an enormous sock from the size of your foot to 60 foot long. So this is it's a long tubular animal, but it's actually not just one animal. It's a community. So it's made up of these little guys called zooids, who are filter feeders. So they strain in the plankton, and they have arranged themselves in this large sock-like formation where they're actually kind of sitting in jelly. So it's all these little zooids, which are only a few millimetres long, sitting in a wider body of jelly shaped like a huge sock. Now, these things are massive, like 60 foot long, 2 metres wide. You could easily fit a human in there. And these, in various shapes and sizes, have started to wash up on the shores stretching from Oregon all the way to Alaska. So this is a massive bloom of these sea pickles. Now, why this is important is because they're getting in the way. So it's a real productive fishing ground. But if the nets are pulling up these massive blooms of sea pickles, then obviously the nets are ripping, the fishermen are getting annoyed. They can't really explain it. So it's like, it's almost like an alien invasion of mysterious things that are just hanging around and getting in the way. They're not attacking us, but they're just getting in the way, and we don't actually know why they've started to arrive. So it's really, if you watch the videos on the, of them online, they're very mysterious, but they're also somewhat calming, because they're just floating up and down in the water column, and during the day they hide, and during
they
the night
hide.
They actually, yeah, so they actually drop down to about 700 meters depth, and then during the night they start to float up because they're bioluminescent. So they're really, really nice to look at.
We are going to be talking about bioluminescence next week, I think. And yeah, I tell you, bioluminescence, the science of that is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
They look like something else to me, but I can't say what it is on radio. But if you want to have a look on Newstalk Science Twitter, you can figure out what you think it might look like. But they don't know where these things come from.
No, they don't. They just come from deep. But it's a really, really strange thing. But actually, one of the really nice things about them is that they multitask. So how they eat is how they move. So they actually, they're filter feeders. So they bring in the water and they strain it through their bodies, the zooids do, and then they expel the water behind once they're done with it. And it's that expulsion of water that actually propels them through the water column.
No way. Okay. Do check out our Twitter, News Talk Science. Our third story really surprised me. This is a finding that bones are not just sort of dead carbon in our bodies. They're so much more than that.
They're definitely not dead carbon. I don't know that we ever thought they were dead carbon.
Well, I guess for me, I just thought they were sort of like a stick.
Certainly
in
until
size.
About a decade ago, you know, we knew bones were constantly reinventing themselves or, you know, replacing old cells. But about 10 years ago, scientists discovered a hormone called osteocalcin. And again, we just thought that bones were using that in this mineralization process to keep themselves strong. But what we found out now is that that hormone seems to be involved in regulating blood sugar. And that's really interesting, because we used to think that hormones, which are chemicals that circulate around your body, just came from glands. So like the thyroid gland in your neck, you often see it enlarged in people who have thyroid problems. And last week, there was a new hormone discovered. And this one is really interesting as well, because what it seems to do is be involved in energy metabolism and appetite suppression. So what we're finding is bones are producing this hormone, massive amounts of it after you eat a meal, or mice are eating a meal. It's going up to the brain and it's suppressing the appetite of those mice to say, stop eating, you've had enough.
So bones are essentially organs?
I think bones are definitely part of the endocrine system, which is what we call all of the glands in your body that are producing hormones. And the fact that we now know of two or three of these molecules that are being produced by bones, they're involved in energy metabolism, regulating blood sugar, and now appetite. So I think it's opening up a whole new area of science. So it's really exciting.
Mm, very interesting. And our final one, Fergus, this is amazing news to me, because horoscopes are real, science says.
Yeah, it's unbelievable in all senses of the word. So we learned this week that the month you're born in has enormous implications for any chronic illness that you're going to get. So, Ruth, what month were you born in?
September.
September. Okay, so you actually appear to have the least chance of being diagnosed with any chronic illness at all, which actually might be related to the fact that you're a Virgo. So you're very calm and conscientious and likely to stay out of trouble.
I'm almost sure that's true.
Almost sure that's true. And Jonathan, you're in
May.
May, and we don't have anything for May. But however, if you were born in June, you would be 34% less likely to suffer from depression and 22% less likely to be diagnosed with lower back pain. So this is a study from the University of Alicante, which looked at 30,000 people, and it's hocus pocus is what it is. This is what happens when you, in science, when you keep testing and testing and testing, you will eventually find something by chance. So they looked at 12 different months and 27 different illnesses. So that gives you a total of 628 possible links. And it just so happens that by chance, some people who are born in different months have slightly different incidences of chronic illness. It's no different actually from horoscopes. In fact, when you learn stats at university level, that's the example that they use of how not to use stats. So you're trying to get a link between the horoscope and an incidence of disease when really there is nothing there. Science is not about putting numbers in and just and believing the significant or the results that come out. There has to be a biological link. There has to be a cause. It has to make sense. sense. And these results in themselves don't actually make sense. And as a result, the paper has been slammed left, right and centre all week.
That's annoying, isn't it? Sometimes, it's, you know, it'd be great to have something completely flip on its head and go, oh my goodness, actually, it turns out that, but actually...
Science generally doesn't work that way, isn't it? It's just another brick in the wall.
Simon texted in, he's from Dublin 3. He says, will we hear the same level of criticism and mockery of Erdogan's lurch to Islamic fundamentalism that we hear about creationists in the US? Expect more and more Islamic states to follow suit as a more radical form of Islam takes hold in Indonesia, Malaysia, the Middle East, Indian subcontinent, etc. Worrying times. I suppose time will tell on that, Simon. And this is, why do they call it a theory? Why not call it a fact? And that's just to do with it was scientific language that just unfortunately chose the same term, even though...
I think with everything in science, I mean, when it was first developed, it was a theory. We didn't have the same kind of information we do now. And that's true with everything. But it's interesting talking about other Islamic countries. I mean, if you look at students in Indonesia and Pakistan and you ask them about evolution, 80, 90% of them, you know, believe in evolution. So, you know, I think it's actually really important. We can worry about what's coming, or we can really start to open up the dialogue to try and help it not happen.
Alan says, don't kid yourself, creationists won't believe any rating scale that questions their own belief in fairy stories. But Paul and Talis says, any chance of the other side of the evolution argument being put forward? Evolution is not a fact, although it may be the best theory available at the moment. Look, I do agree with that in some respect. Your scientists have never observed something evolving from one species to another. Is all she or anyone else has observed is a growth of an organism or a change within a species. Do you want to, I mean, like, I think I understand in that you can never say 100%, you know, about some things, but as close as we can get to a fact.
But I think, I mean, you talked about the human evolution story where, you know, what scientists had thought was that humans came out of Africa about 200,000 years ago. And then new fossils were found in around Morocco, I think it was, that seemed to be older humans than that and suggested they had come out about 300,000 years ago. But the reality is you were talking about small fragments of jaws and skulls and pieces of tools. And we are using better and better technologies to date where those come from. But the line between all of these different hominoid or, you know, human type species is not that clear. And actually, I think one of the best analogies I've heard is from Richard Dawkins. I mean, what he says is you don't go to bed middle-aged one day and wake up old the next day. Yeah. These changes are imperceptible and tiny. However, if you take a photograph of someone when they're 30 and when they're 60, you can quite obviously see the differences. Yeah. And put that in a millions of years time scale. And, you know, that's where it's difficult to get your head around that.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty good example.
Future proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Puberty. We've all got to go through it, and many, like me, are going to have to try to explain it to people in the not-too-distant future. But what exactly is puberty? Well, here to join me and talk about it is Frank Biro, who's a professor of paediatrics at Cincinnati University. Welcome to the programme, Frank. How are you?
Good morning. How are you doing? Oh, good day. How are you doing?
You're quite all right. Frank, can I ask you, do we fully understand why humans go through puberty at all?
Sure. So there's a number of different theories that have arisen about that. Probably the most sense would be that we're using a lot of energy in order to grow taller, to develop our organs fully, and that if we were reproductively competent at the time of birth, then we would be devoting that energy to trying to develop another generation. So to probably enhance the success, as in many other animals, we're born reproductively immature, and we develop this capacity once we've achieved adult height, adult stature, strength, and organ.
Oh, so basically we hold off on reproducing until we are strong enough, smart enough, and aware of our environment enough to invest the energy it takes to become ready to reproduce?
I think that's a very good resolution of that. I'd like to think most people are smart enough and strong enough in order to do that. I think that some people somehow get by without doing some of those factors.
Yeah. Is the purpose of puberty then to get the body ready to reproduce? Is that the whole purpose of it?
So with puberty, the brain tells the rest of the body to go through a growth spurt. It tells the body, you know, you've got to acquire more energy. So, you know, there's an increase in caloric intake. There's signals being sent literally to every organ in the body to undergo rapid changes. The only time that there's growth acceleration, that is an increase in the growth rate, occurs with the pubertal growth spurt. And that, you know, whereas the reproductive organs are infantile at birth by definition, there's a dramatic change in their volume and the responsiveness to certain hormonal stimuli as you go through puberty. So there are rapid and dramatic changes that occur in those 3 to 4 years.
Isn't it true that you can both conceive and give birth before you reach the age of puberty?
That's an excellent question. Most girls don't hit their first menstrual period, and even with the first menstrual period, which is called menarche, they still may not be ovulating or releasing eggs for the first 1 to 2 years after menarche. In other words, that first menstrual period may just be sloughing the line of the womb, and that there may not have been an egg released. There are cases in which girls have released an egg, have ovulated at that time, but they're almost case reports. So although young women and less so young men do achieve reproductive competence before they finish puberty, most don't. For example, the sperm in young men really doesn't have the ability as much as an older man to penetrate the egg and to achieve fertilization of that egg, something called capacitance. That doesn't. That usually doesn't occur until a year or two after they have completed puberty entirely.
Yeah, but like I was researching this and I was absolutely amazed and horrified at the story of Lina Marcela Medina de Jurado, who in 1933 was born, and in 1938, at the age of 5, became the youngest mother still in the history of history. And
yes.
If you can give birth at the age of 5, then I'm trying to figure out why the body needs to do puberty at all.
Okay. So I, you know, not having met the young woman or her children, if baby doesn't sort of have a lot of nutritional stores in order to sort of develop and grow, then that infant will probably be born not only premature, but also be born small relative to that gestational age.
Yeah.
And those
what you would
place,
imagine so, yeah.
Yeah, and those place the child at a lot of risk, health, and other risks later in life. So that if you want to sort of have optimization of the species, you're going to have, and what will be selected over the years will be, you know, whoever achieves, stronger, faster, smarter.
Yeah. So I mean, there are sort of these outliers throughout history, but in general, the people who've reached puberty and beyond are the people who are going to be the ideal carriers of healthy babies and so on. Talk to me about your research and what you'd look at in terms of puberty.
Certainly, thank you. So we've conducted several longitudinal studies over the years. We typically have selected ages that would be prepubertal, both boys and girls. I cut my teeth 30 some years ago on doing this longitudinal study of boys, but then over the past 15 years have been following this group of girls who were 6 and 7 when we recruited them in their schools. And surprisingly, we found quite a few of those young ladies already in early pubertal maturation. That was a little bit we didn't anticipate that. We were looking at the ages of the girls who had typically reported puberty, and we thought maybe we'd get 1 or 2%, but it was a much higher number.
So these girls were starting puberty at what age? What, 8 or 9?
Some of the girls started it before that.
Puberty and before 8 or 9?
Yes. And so what we did was we were measuring urine and blood for different types of chemical exposures. We were also measuring blood for sex hormone levels. We were doing a lot of measurements of their height and their weight and their body proportions. And what we found was that, and not surprisingly, that girls who are heavier hit puberty earlier. That's been shown by several different studies. Our numbers of early maturing girls were much greater than in many of the preceding papers that had been published. And then we started looking at some of these environmental exposures. And we concentrated on those called endocrine disrupting chemicals.
Okay.
So some of the good news is that we found that there were quite a few chemicals that are typically in our diets. So I'm talking about the phytoestrogens. And the phytoestrogens tended to actually delay pubertal onset a little bit. The trouble with the way that we were looking at things is that we were measuring over 100 exposures, and the models that we're using can only accommodate, you know, one or two or three chemicals at a time, and we really live in an ocean of chemicals. The 21st and 20th centuries introduced a lot of different chemicals into the environment, and so that, you know, our sample size was such that we would lose the power to be able to look at differences if we selected many hormones all at the same time.
So what are you telling me, though, Frank?
Okay, what I'm telling you is that there are some exposures, especially the phytoestrogens. These are plant sources of estrogens that appear to delay puberty in girls a little bit. And we found that there were some chemicals that we use in common everyday household products or personal care products that might have changed the body to increase the body mass and led to, with the increase in body mass, that the girls may have hit puberty earlier.
So you're saying that the beauty products that were being used in a household may have influenced the weight of a child who then enters puberty at age 7?
At an earlier age.
So what sort of products are we talking about? We need to be careful that you know, that these products have the same ingredients in America and Europe, but what can you say for certain?
Okay. Well, nothing's for certain in this world. We're only looking at associations. And even though we say that the probability that this occurs by chance is 1 in 100, you can still pull that purple marble out of the bag 1 out of 100 times. So we're just looking at associations. We didn't feed the girls these chemicals and say, oh, look, that one is heavier and went into puberty earlier.
Okay.
So this is just an observational study. But what we found was that plasticizers, phthalates, which are used on both sides of the pond. These are the products that allow plastics to be more plastic. These are some of the products that help the scents and aromas that are in our soaps and our other personal care products to stabilize those scents or to stabilize the products. So the phthalates have been shown in several different studies, including ours, to increase body mass, especially central body mass.
Wow. And the other factor that seems to influence this early onset puberty has to do with wealth.
Yes. So we've reported a little bit about it. There's been other groups of investigators that have also looked at that. And so if you looked at it 50 years ago, those who were more socioeconomically privileged typically hit puberty earlier. But in our contemporary groups, those who were socioeconomically disadvantaged hit puberty earlier.
But why would that be? So 50 years ago, if you were rich, you hit puberty earlier, and now if you're poor, you hit puberty earlier?
Yes.
Why?
Yes, that's what the more recent. There's probably a number of different factors that are included in that. And
Do we know why?
Well, I think that there was a recent paper by Sun that came out and said that just being exposed to this lower socioeconomic environment with many different factors, and you know, they controlled for where the neighborhood was. But one of the things is that it is sort of what the neighborhoods include. For example, if you go in a supermarket in a wealthy area, typically you have very fresh vegetables and fruits that are appealing. If you go into some of those supermarkets in socioeconomically disadvantaged areas, that the fruit and vegetables may be day old and much less appealing to be consumed. And we know that fruits and vegetables, if they contain these phytoestrogens, tend to delay puberty. So there's one thing that could be going on. Another thing could be sort of the opportunity to engage in physical activity, that, you know, a difference between a nice little park with very well-kept grass and equipment, as contrasted to in the inner city where, you know, it might even be a dangerous area because of the exchange of certain illicit chemicals that might occur in that area. But there could be differences of factors of the stress in the household.
Hmm. But we know that stress brings on puberty earlier, does it?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Stress,
I'm trying to figure out why there's been that flip, though, that if, you know, 50 years ago you were richer, it would bring on puberty earlier, and now it's poorer. Right? Why would 50 years ago being rich bring on puberty earlier?
Well, because they probably had access to better food, higher quality food,
right,
better protein sources, that perhaps their dietary intake reflected a better all-around composition representing all the different food groups.
Okay.
But it's easy to eat poorly. You can do that very inexpensively, unfortunately.
Well, Frank Barrow, Professor of Pediatrics at Cincinnati University, thanks very much for coming on.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Now, you come to a fork in the road. What is it that makes you decide to turn left instead of right? What makes you decide the sign was blue or had white writing in the first place? Well, here to talk to me about the science behind decision-making is Professor Redmond O'Connell. He's Associate Professor at the Trinity College Institute of Neuroscience and School of Psychology. Welcome to Future Proof, Redmond. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
Is a decision just the same? Are all decisions the same?
Well, that's kind of one of the big questions behind the research in this area. So when most people think about decision-making, they're thinking about things like, you know, what will I have for dinner tonight, or how will I vote in this election? But the reality is that our whole lives consist of a series of choices, many of which are really simple and straightforward, many of which we're not even aware that we're making. So one example would be, say, when you're driving in traffic, deciding whether or not the brake light on the car in front is on or off can be just as life-changing as those other decisions.
Huh. Is that a decision?
Yeah, so that's not as obvious, right? There's no intuitive sense of actually making a decision. You just know when the light's on. You don't really have to think about it. But when you actually think about how information is represented in the brain, it turns out that it's very complicated for the brain to allow you to know that so quickly. And when you look at how the brain actually solves that problem, it turns out it looks a lot like a decision. So if you think about, for example, colour, like there's a particular area and the visual region of the brain called area V4, where you find neurons that are sensitive to particular colors, and each neuron has its own preference. So a given neuron.
Oh, wow. Each neuron, one would be red, one would be blue, one would be green.
Exactly, yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
How do you know that?
So the visual system, well, that's achieved by recording from neurons in those areas of the brain. So work has been done in kind of characterizing the different preferences of different neurons in the visual system and in the auditory system and so on over decades. But just by presenting different stimuli, different types of information to, say, a participant or an animal, and then recording from different neurons in different areas of the brain, you kind of find out, oh, this neuron, it seems to speak up whenever the participant is shown something red. But, for example, it's not really doing much when it's looking at a word or something like that. The thing is that those neurons, there's thousands of them, and they respond, so they'll have a favorite. So they might respond in particular to, say, dark red. But they'll also respond a little bit to light red, and they might even also respond a little bit to yellow and orange. Less, but they'll still respond a little bit. So neurons are never perfect. They're noisy. They'll even make little mistakes, and they'll speak out of turn and things like that. So if you look at one single little snapshot of what's going on in, say, that area V4 while somebody's looking at the colour red, it'd actually be quite difficult to tell what colour they're looking at based on that information. But somehow the brain can make sense of it nonetheless. And that's kind of, therefore that kind of makes this sort of decision into something actually quite interesting and mysterious. And that's something that people have been researching for a long time. It turns out, you know, even those really basic decisions we have struggled to understand, but there's been some really interesting insights revealed over the last few decades.
So this is the idea that if you take a snapshot of these neurons at any point in time, they give you some information, but actually it's almost like a photo versus a movie.
Exactly. It's
a movie of these images that's required for you to get an idea of what we're looking at. Is it a red thing or a blue thing or a green
that's
thing?
That's it. So it turns out what the brain does is take a movie exactly of what's going on in a region like that and then judge over time what seems to be the pattern. And that time might actually be very short again. So if something like, is the brake light on or off? Just a few milliseconds and the brain can do it. But it's still, the brain works at such a fast speed that a few milliseconds is still a significant amount of time. So it can look at what's going on over time, over a few different snapshots, a few photographs or over a movie, and put that together and then come to a much more accurate decision. And that's the key, is that you don't kind of base anything on just one snapshot in time. You take a longer view on what's going on. And it turns out that if you look at the kind of formula the brain is using to solve that kind of problem, it looks very similar to the types of formula that we use to solve much more complex problems. So like that kind of formula that has been studied for a long time, but kind of one of the early pieces of work that kind of really inspired a lot of research in this field actually occurred in World War II, where the American military had this problem that they needed to produce huge amounts of weapons and ammunition to send out to the soldiers in the field, and they needed to do it really quick. But they also needed to make sure the weapons and the bullets were actually working so the poor soldiers wouldn't be left holding duds. But the problem was that if they were to check every single gun and every single bullet, the war would be long over before they got through them all. So they needed to find some way of kind of getting a decent level of accuracy in checking these weapons, but also finishing the job in a decent amount of time, in a feasible amount of time. So they turned to a mathematician called Abraham Wald, and he came up with the best solution, you know, on a kind of mathematical solution to the problem, which was to treat quality control as an evidence accumulation process. So let's say you're testing a batch of bombs. What you can do is you can test one bomb at a time, and each test counts as a piece of evidence in favor of either accepting this batch of bombs or rejecting them. And what you do is you don't base your decision on just one test. You add each piece of evidence to the next, and you're kind of calculating a running total. You're taking a movie over time. And then once you have enough evidence, you kind of decide how much evidence you need for one choice or another. Then you can stop. So that way you can save time.
So in the case of Wald, he'd look at a box of 20 munitions, for example, and he would say, okay, this one's okay, this one's okay, this one's okay. This one's a dud, this one's okay, this batch looks all right, and he could ship that off. But if he got maybe three duds in the first five, he'd say, dump that.
Exactly.
So sort of a shorthand for guesstimating what the rest of the sample looks like. It sounds a bit like Bayesian mathematics.
That's it. So it's all about kind of setting like your error rate in advance. You're kind of, well, how many mistakes am I willing to make? Okay, I'm willing to let, like, say, one dud go out for every 100 guns I'm sending. Well, then, you know, if that's my rule, then it's very unlikely that there's going to be any more than 100 if I've checked, say, like 20 and I haven't found a dud yet. So then I can kind of say, I'll stop there. You know, so, you know, whereas if you're wanting to be more cautious, then you can wait longer. Or if you're, you know, willing to be a little bit riskier, then you can actually base your decision on less. And that formula actually is the way of coming up with the best, given a fixed amount of time, coming up with the most accurate decisions.
And that's how our brains make these micro decisions that we're sometimes not even aware of.
Yeah, so like it's actually a nice example of how, like, why it's really important for different branches of science to speak to each other, because this was stuff that was developed in again, the realm of quality control by a mathematician. We got picked up by psychologists who thought, oh, maybe this is how the brain solves these problems. So this is, we're talking that the 60s and 70s, they started to play around with computer models. They train a computer model to make decisions in this way. And it turns out the model behaved in a way that was very similar to human behavior on even those really simple, what we call perceptual decisions about colors and lights and things like that. So the computer would make similar pattern of errors and reaction times. And then, but even then, that was quite an obscure kind of branch of psychology, people playing around with these computer models. But the big kind of aha moment was when a group of physiologists in the US actually recorded from particular areas of the brain. And they these are areas of the brain that are involved in preparing eye movements. So in these tasks, say they had an animal performing a task, say judging the direction of motion of an object, and if the object's moving to the left, they had to move their eyes to the left. If it was moving to the right, they had to move their eyes to the right. And so they're looking at these neurons that are involved in preparing that movement. And those neurons behaved in a way that was just incredibly similar to Abraham Wald's evidence accumulation process. It looked just like it. So like that idea that like a theory, a kind of, a Bayesian theory or a psychological theory would actually just directly map on to neural activity in that way is really surprising.
So what's your research into specifically, Robin? What kind of questions are you hoping to answer?
Well, so my research, where I came in, was that those kinds of signals had only ever been looked at in animals thus far. So we're talking about rodents and monkeys. And that obviously really limits the kinds of questions you can ask. And so in the last few years,
banana, nuts.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
That's it. We're done.
So what we did was we developed techniques for actually isolating those types of signals in humans. So we use a technique called EEG or electroencephalography, where you're wearing a special cap and the cap has these electrodes on it. And the electrodes pick up the natural electrical activity that neurons in your brain produce when they're firing. So it's not invasive or anything like that. But when we record that while participants are doing these types of decision-making tasks, we were able to, again, isolate a signal that behaved just like the signals that had been observed directly in the brains of animals, and then also that corresponded a lot to Abraham Wald's theory. And what's cool about these signals is that they really precisely predict both the choice the participant is going to make, about to make, so you can predict in advance, and also when they're going to make that choice as well. So we're kind of getting a direct...
Yeah, it's quite creepy.
It is kind of creepy. Like, for example, we did an experiment where... so usually we in these experiments, we ask people to click with their left hand if they're going to go... If say, it's moving to the left, and click with their right hand if it's moving to the right. But we did a version of the experiment where we didn't ask them to make any overt movement at all. We just asked them to count in their head every time they saw the thing move. And to tell us afterwards, so they'd do the task, say, for 5 minutes, and tell us afterwards how many times they'd seen it. And we see the same signal. So we don't even need them to actually do anything. We can like read out, to some degree anyway, the decision they're making without them having to move in any way.
I'm imagining the sci-fi application of that, which is, of course, sitting down at dinner and the waiter just walking up and looking at you and then walking away. What's the practical? I mean, what's the point of this research? What can you tell us about the human brain and how we think?
Yeah, well, so I mean, we're some way off that level of understanding. It's only, you know, we have to define the parameters of the decisions that a participant is allowed to make, and then within that kind of experiment, we're able to tell whether they're leaning one way or the other. But it's not at the point where we can just look at the signals and know what they're thinking about or what they're deciding. But what we can do is kind of start to look at like some of the interesting questions about the factors that shape our decision making. And there's a lot of big questions. Like, one of them is, how do we balance the competing demands for fast versus accurate decisions? So like that really good example you gave at the beginning, like when you're driving towards a fork in the road, it's actually more important to make a quick decision or a decision on time than it is to make an accurate decision. So if you make no decision, you're going to smash into the dividing wall. You're better off going off in the wrong direction and correcting it afterwards. So it's a really important part of our decision making. Actually, it could influence our decisions in so many ways, even ethical decisions that we make. You know, a juror in the courtroom, you know, if they have more emphasis on the speed of their decisions than in the accuracy of the decisions, they might, you know, define the kinds of decisions they're going to make. So what's cool is that even though we might be looking at these really kind of constrained experiments where we're looking at these really simplistic types of decisions, we're still hoping to get insights into really fundamental aspects of decision making in general. And it's only really by looking directly at neural activity that we can answer these sorts of questions and test these theories.
Rebin O'Connell from Trinity College, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Right, very good. Now, last week's show was about global seed vaults and the science of tanning and lots of other stuff. Lots of your texts coming in. One person says, don't suppose science has worked out how to give albinos a bit of pigment yet. Another says, I'm an albino. Can he give me a bit of a tan? That's from Claire. I think he was talking about redheads, so I don't know. I actually don't know the biological mechanism that results in albinoness. So I'm not sure. I don't know. Is albino a lack of pigment completely? Yeah. Okay. So I don't know is the answer. Sorry about that. Another says, that seed bank is incredible. There are more than 930,000 samples of seeds locked deep in their vaults. Indeed. Another person texted in about that tanning thing. They said, tanning pills are vanity. People either need the sun or are forced to live or work in places with exposure. And then it says, our product is better than tan, hashtag skincare. And this is a Cork company that make plant-derived compounds, and they're reinventing the formulation of sun care products to enhance consumers' beauty and health. Go on, yeah, but I'm not going to mention the name of the product. Someone else says, what about spuds? Please tell me we're going to freeze the spuds. And Colin says the same thing. And I have to apologize to Andy. Andy says, you read out the question I texted in yesterday, but you didn't answer my question. Using conservation of momentum, can you explain the free fall of Building 7 on 9/11 for 2.5 seconds as reported by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology? This should be a simple question to answer. Please respond to me. Thanks, Andy. Andy, is this because you believe 9/11 is a hoax? You can text us that. And if you text me a really good answer as to why I should fuel that thing that's going on in your brain, I promise you I will read it next week's podcast. That's it from us for this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, as Andy did, science@newstalk.com. you can also find us on Twitter 24/7. That's @newstalkscience. Thanks to Claire Diamond, who is producing, Rona Brannock, who is researching with Jen Larrigan. We will be back next Saturday with more Future Proof. Of course, if you want to listen to the show live, it goes out 12 p.m. Irish time. Otherwise, I'll see you somewhere on the internet.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.